The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this June 12th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and we are always available via podcast. I will give you more information on that later in the show. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara DeMarco Barrett is here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. It is my honor to be rejoined by Colm McCann, who was last on the show with me talking about Let the Great World Spin. He's back with his latest novel, Transatlantic. And in the second half hour, Joan Silber will be here talking about her short story collection, Fools. Colm McCann is the internationally best-selling author of the novels Let the Great World Spin, Zoli, Dancer, This Side of Brightness, and Song Dogs, as well as two critically acclaimed story collections. His fiction has been published in 35 languages. He has received many honors, including the National Book Award, the International IMPAC Dublin Literary Award, and the Ireland Fund of Monaco Literary Award in memory of Princess Grace. He's been named one of Esquire's best and brightest, and his short film, Everything in This Country Must, was nominated for an Oscar in 2005. A contributor to The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic, The Paris Review, he teaches at Hunter College, MFA Creative Writing Program. The book is Transatlantic. It's published by Random House, and it's my pleasure to welcome him this morning. Colm, hi.
It's my pleasure to be back again.
Welcome.
How are you?
Welcome back. I'm well. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you very, very much.
Good, good. Well, no one can introduce their novel better than the writer himself, so I'm going to let you talk about Transatlantic and how it came to be.
Well, my standard quip these days is, you know, when people say, "What is your novel about?" I say, "Well, it's about 301 pages," because sometimes it's hard to encapsulate exactly what you know, what a novel is about, except in the sense that on a very direct level, it takes three major transatlantic journeys that were done from the United States or from North America to Ireland. The first being Frederick Douglass's trip to Ireland in 1845. He landed there still a slave to deliver a series of lectures about abolition. An incredible story when he comes up against the Irish famine. The second one is the story of Alcock and Brown, two RAF aviators who flew from Newfoundland to Ireland in 1919, actually 8 years or 7 years before Lindbergh himself did it. They sort of took the war out of the machine by replacing the bomb bays with petrol tanks, and did this incredible open cockpit journey. I can't believe it. I've been traveling on planes now the last few days myself, and the idea of traveling in an open cockpit going across the Atlantic is just still astounding to me. But they did that in 1919, and the third one is a very contemporary journey or series of journeys done by the great Senator George Mitchell, who went back and forth between Washington, D.C. and New York to Belfast to help us negotiate our peace process in Ireland. And all of these stories then are linked in by the narratives of women, four generations of women who go back and forth between Ireland and the United States. I suppose it's a novel about desire, it's a novel about peace, it's a novel about the past intersecting with the present. And so now you can see exactly why I tell people it's about 300 pages.
A good summary. I know, I was hoping you'd summarize it because I'm like, I'd have no idea what to say, but I knew you would. So you have this fascination across a lot of your books, I don't know if all of your books, to take on real characters, shall we say, real people who existed in the world and set them in sort of fictionalized settings. I think a challenge for a number of reasons, but talk about that decision, what it does for you and maybe what some of the constrictions are, but maybe what the advantages are.
Well, I gave an interview about 12 years ago or so, where I said that it showed an absolute failure of the imagination on behalf of the writer to start writing about real characters. And here I am. But I did embark then very shortly afterwards to write about Rudolf Nureyev in a novel called Dancer, and then in the last book I had, Let the Great World Spin, I used Philippe Petit and his tightrope walk across the World Trade Center towers as a metaphor, as a pull through, and this time around again use sort of quote unquote non-fiction stories. But what interests me is that I actually don't see any difference between fiction and non-fiction, because it seems to me that the real is very much an imagined thing, mm-hmm. and the imagination can become just as real as anything else, in the sense that, say, a novel with a beautiful book like Ulysses, Leopold Bloom is just as real to me as any of the characters that were alive in Dublin, including my own great-grandfather, mm. whom I never met. The existence of quote unquote fictional characters can be mediated by a writer and to make them just as real as anybody else, and that's an interesting thing to me, because I don't really agree with the word fiction. I don't like it all that much, though I use it a lot. I still don't like it. It's a term of convenience. I prefer to say stories or storytelling, mm-hmm. Which I think we all own.
Yeah, I had read an interview that you gave where you were talking about a friend from Bosnia, and they said in Bosnia they don't even have the words fiction and nonfiction. It's
right.
All just story.
Yeah,
and
that's Alexander Heyman, the great novelist who lives in Chicago, comes originally from Sarajevo, wrote Lazarus Project, Question of Bruno. He has a new book out, the Book of My Lives. Sasha, he was telling me that there is no word in his own language for this, which seems appropriate, mm-hmm. to me. I mean, often I think we do it for the purposes of being able to shelve them in bookshops, or for the Library of Congress, or whatever reason it happens to be. But essentially, we all make up our stories, even when we're dealing with the supposed truth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these truths, these are things that are manipulated by politicians, too, to send our kids off to war, or by corporations to get us to buy the latest diet-free, whatever it happens to be. So I think one of the functions of all of this is to question what's real, to question what's presented to us as history and what's presented to us as news, so that we have a more varied and sort of, I suppose, a more muscular sort of idea of what the truth is.
Yeah. To that end, how much time do you focus on kind of getting their biography right, or reading things they've read? How much? Where do you pick up the thread on your own from their own material?
Well, here's the contradiction in all of this: is that you have to be responsible. You have to be responsible to the texture of what you find to be true, not necessarily the facts. But I mean, you can't go along and have outrageous things happening with the, unless you're intentionally doing it. But say, for example, with Frederick Douglass, who's a character in the book, I know for a fact that he had barbells, because in his house in Washington, D.C., there's a museum, and they took sort of a snapshot of his life in the 1870s, and he used barbells. My story takes place in Ireland in the 1840s, but I give him those same barbells. I don't know, nobody knows, whether he took them with him or not. But in this piece, I have him taking them because it gives texture. It talks about him and the idea of his body and his stamina and his desire and all these things that were sort of incredible about somebody like Frederick Douglass, mm-hmm. So he lands a black slave in Ireland and stays in the houses of the wealthy, and he wants to keep himself in shape, and he's very aware, he's hyper aware of his own existence in the world, and I thought it was a great metaphor. So whether or not he took the barbells, I don't care. In my story, he takes the barbells, and I think that's one of the great liberating things about fiction. But you have to be responsible to a sort of deep form of the truth, or what you at least hope is a deep form of the truth.
Yeah. I love that. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI. My guest this morning is Colin McCann. The book is Transatlantic. Do you, as you look across the themes of all of the work that you've done, do you see similarities between the books? And do you, are there areas of concern that kind of keep coming up for you that you feel like you're continuing to grapple with, even though the stories are very different?
Yeah, I mean, the stories are always different, and I always try to push myself in a new direction. But I suppose, we all have obsessions within us that whether they're conscious or not. If you're too conscious of them, I think they can become a problem. You say you decide, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to write a novel about faith, for instance, and I think. That would restrict it, but much of my novels are actually about the notion of faith, faith in the past, faith that something good will happen in the future, faith in one's own existence, and then faith in God as well too. These notions sort of move through the work, but if there's any one thing I'm sort of really overwhelmed by, particularly now, it's by the fact that we that stories are the things that legislate us, and stories tie us together in the most extraordinary way. And stories are the great democracy that we have, and we tell each other stories for all sorts of reasons. And I think I've been writing about that for quite a while.
Yeah.
Also, for the first time in quite a while. In Transatlantic, I go back to Ireland. I go back, obviously, in the guise of Frederick Douglass. I go back in the guise of Senator George Mitchell. But still, I sort of go back and negotiate my country that I left 25 years ago. I go home all the time, 5-6 times a year. But I hadn't gone back fictionally or in storytelling for quite a while.
Do you think your relationship to Ireland, given the distance, I know you go back frequently, but sort of given the distance, has made it easier to write about it when you kind of have this exterior, I don't want to say objective, but sort of exterior approach to it?
No, I like the position of the outsider. I like the privileged position of the outsider, that person who can just stand like right on the edge and look inwards and hopefully, catch... a good moment in flight. I think it's a good thing to be able to stand just on the edge and look back. I mean, that's the reason why a lot of writers left Ireland. But of course, there are many, many more who, particularly nowadays, who stay at home and look at it from the inside. I don't think one is better than the other. I don't think it's more privileged to be looking at it from the inside or more privileged to be looking at it from the outside. It's just the way the writer himself or herself chooses to do it. And for me personally, I don't think I would be, I know for a fact I wouldn't be the writer that I am now if I hadn't left. But I'm glad to have left. I'm not trying to diss my own country, but for me it gave me a perspective, and I can hear the voice of Ireland in a whole load of things, no matter where I happen to be. And I don't know if I'd have stayed in Ireland if that would be the same thing.
It's a country that produces so many incredible writers. And, you're playing with language and sort of the way that you deconstruct language and put things back together in really lovely ways. I was, I don't know if there's something about the Irish brogue or something about the country itself that produces these really lovely writers, but...
It's in the whiskey. It really is. It has to be. I remember I was just recalling with a friend last night how when we got sick as kids, my mother and father would give us a hot whiskey with cloves and lemon to go off to bed with, and we were like 7, 8, 9 years old. I don't know any other place that would do that. But, being serious now, I mean, it is in the long tradition of the Shanachies, the storytellers. It is the fact that our language got taken away from us, the Irish language, and that this other language was foisted upon us, and we use it sometimes as a tool of violence even to get back. And Joyce actually talked about like Irish writers, recorrecting history by by using the language better than the English themselves used it, you know. Also, there's music, and there's a little bit of abandon, and also, I think there is a fairly privileged position of the artist in society. Certainly, the writer seems to be, you know, admired, and you know, somebody like Seamus Heaney is so important to the whole imagination, you know.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about structure, because I marveled at it in Let the Great World Spin. I marveled at it again, and I know you can't tell me how to do it, but maybe we could talk about it just a little bit, because the structuring of your novels is just incredible. I think it's the reason that I couldn't tell the audience what your novel was about myself. Right. But you've talked about structures, music, or structures, architecture, or structures sort of mathematical. Yeah. Do you kind of sit with it and say, you know, I need more flute, or there are too many strings, and kind of, you know, what does that mean? What is the flute and what are the strings when you're trying to do this balance?
Well, that's a really good way to put it. That's a really good way to put it. Because I suppose I arrive in the building as a sort of confused conductor, and I meet all these musicians, and I say, okay, lads, let's get together, and everyone goes down into the pit, and you sort of like you get them to try out their instruments, and suddenly, you know, a while into it, you begin to hear music, and I don't know what the structure of the music is going to be. But you hear it, and then when you hear it, it sounds right. It's like trying to solve a complex problem in mathematics. It's almost like that eureka moment. You know, you sit in the bath, and the water rises, and suddenly you have the formula. You hear the sentence, and it sounds right. You say, ah, there you go, got it. Now move on. And again, you move on. And I wish I could tell you that I plotted them out and that I had some sort of structure, but really, the structure is found by the language. It's never imposed beforehand. So as a conductor, you basically, you know, get in there for months or for years, and you have all the musicians do their different pieces until you find some sort of music that sounds right, and you hope that it's good. But you know, I teach at Hunter College, as you said, and Don DeLillo came to talk to my students one time, and they were talking to him about his fantastic structure and all this sort of stuff. And he sat down, and modest and wonderful man as he is, he just said, he pulled down his cap over his head, and he sort of said, embarrassed, you know, sometimes I seem to be the benefactor of an occasional revelation. And I thought, nice. Yes, that's nice. Exactly what it's like. It's just every now and then something comes along and hits you.
Yeah, right. Right. My guest this morning is Colin McCann. The book is Transatlantic, and you are listening to Writers on Writing. Notes about character and some of the characters that surprised you, some of the characters that maybe aren't leaving you alone so much. You know, these people that sort of inhabit your head. I was actually wondering if I could get, I don't know if it's metaphysical or psychological or something, but I'm wondering if these characters sort of represent your own psychological stuff that presents itself to you in, you know, kind of human form, and, you know, if that accounts for why some characters don't leave writers alone, or if some characters just never quite sing loud enough or something.
Yeah, well, I think so. I think it must be. I mean, the thing is, especially if you're writing towards what you want to know, especially if you're writing outside of your realm, outside of your immediate body, which is kind of what I tend to do. I take subjects that are quite distant from my immediate life. I mean, I live in New York. I'm a father. I got three kids. You know, I teach in a university. You know, it's not on the surface the most exciting life. But when I go in and start to write, I write about all these things that obsess me and are sort of thrilling to me. You know, certain characters are stronger and better than others. And in not writing about myself, it becomes a form of sort of, maybe even a form of deeper autobiography than if I sat down and started to tell people, you know, this is my life. I mean, the prospect of a memoir filled me with all sorts of dread. I couldn't do it. I really couldn't do it. Mind you, I'll probably eat my words in a few years, but right now, I would bore the living daylights out of myself if I had to write about myself. But writing about others is really fun because I don't have to be myself. And some of them work and some of them don't. And so you're right, it has to be some sort of psychological, unconscious autobiography mm-hmm. With each word that you put down.
I was wondering if research drove any of the components of this novel, if something came out of the research, because it sounds very language-driven and very character-driven and more organic, but I was wondering if in the course of researching this, I know for Dancer you actually danced on stage as a ballet dancer, I love that, and if there was any, you know, sort of fun research moments in this, and if something came out of them.
I gotta tell you, this whole thing about ballet dancing, this is the funniest thing in the world to me. Like, people meet me and like they look at me and say, "You were a ballet dancer," and I wasn't. I mean, the thing is, but I did like practice on stage with a dancer just in the Kirov once, just to get the hang of things. But I will tell you, the honest to God truth is that there were six ballerinas in the front row laughing their rear ends off at how bad I was, and there's a big Babushka in the back sweeping up just like shaking her head no. And so like my research, even though I like it, doesn't necessarily mean that I deeply engage in it. But I did for Transatlantic, I did fly a plane, and our co-pilot a plane. It terrified the living daylights out of me. And I did, you know, do some walking around Ireland to try and figure out, you know, some of the landscape that Frederick Douglass was in. And I did do a lot of research on Senator George Mitchell. I talked to Tony Blair. I talked to diplomats. But part of that is I like my life and I like meeting people and I like getting out and about and having a laugh and engaging with the world. I'm not one to sit in the room, close the curtains and create. I like the collision of the imagination and the real. So every book is kind of like a bit like a university course for me.
I like that. Sometimes I take the risk and ask writers if they had any weird experiences or coincidences or something that sort of spoke to you during the long, laborious process of writing to tell you kind of cosmically you're on the right track. And half the time I get dead air from that question, but now and then something good comes out of it. And I'm wondering if things either in this book or in any of the other books that you've written, sort of aha moments or something coincidental or something spoke to you saying, you know, keep going, you're doing the right job.
God, it happens all the time for me. I mean, that's the sort of thing that you know, sometimes freaks me out that it happens sort of so often that something comes along and blindsides you and you realize how connected the world is. But for example, I was writing about Senator George Mitchell, who, as your listeners know, he's live and well and living in Maine and New York. So I knew he was a tennis player, and started writing about him as a tennis player, and I was imagining him. I hadn't yet interviewed him. I interviewed him much, much later. So I wanted to put the imaginary map down first. And lo and behold, so much of the imaginary exercise turned out to be correct. Like, for example, I've had him playing in a tennis club called Stranmillis Tennis Club in Belfast. Now, there are a few tennis clubs in Belfast, but and I suppose there's no great shakes that I imagined him being there, but he actually had gone there every day. And in the scene, I imagine him seeing an All-Ireland women's tennis tournament. And he said to me, that is freaky. How did you know that I was at an All-Ireland women's tennis tournament? And, you know, there was a couple of things like that sort of gave me the feeling that, yes, this was correct. You sort of have to go on. And same thing happened to me when I wrote about Rudolf Nureyev in a novel called Dancer. You know, I imagined a lot of it, and then his friends came along and afterwards and said, well, how did you know that? And how did you know that? And I suppose it's just, some of it's just part luck, some of it's chance, and some of it's partly written in our DNA, if you're trying to get it, if you're trying to get it honest, you know. Maybe there's some sort of, I'm the furthest thing, I promise you, from a new agey sort of bloke, just no thanks. But you know, maybe there are certain things in the air that every now and then they're designed to sort of coincide and say, ah, the world is held together with invisible strings, you know.
Yep, yep. My guest this morning is Colin McCann. The book is Transatlantic. We're drawing down, but I'd love for you to just read just a little to us. Can you read to us?
For sure, I can. I can read something that I haven't read. I've been traveling a little bit now, and I've never read the preface to the novel, which actually contains the key to the whole novel. But only after you've read the whole thing would you understand it afterwards. Would that be okay? About 1 minute or so?
Absolutely perfect. Yep.
Okay. It's 2012. The cottage sat at the edge of the loch. She could hear the wind and the rain whipping across the expanse of open water. It hit the trees and muscled its way into the grass. She began to wake early in the morning, even before the children. It was a house worth listening to. Odd sounds from the roof. She thought at first that it might be rats scuttling across the slate, but she soon discovered that it was gulls flying overhead, dropping oysters on the roof to break the shells open. It happened mostly in the morning, sometimes at dusk. The shells pinged first, silent a moment as they bounced, followed by a jingling roll along the roof until they tumbled down into the long grass, which was spotted with whitewash. When a shell tip hit directly, it cracked open. But if it dropped sideways through the sky, it wouldn't break. It lay there like a thing unexploded. The gulls swooped acrobatic upon the broken shells. Their hunger briefly solved, they flapped off towards the water once more in squadrons of blue and grey. Soon the rooms began to stir, the opening of windows, cupboards and doors, the wind off the lock moving through the house.
Hmm. That was Colin McCann reading from the introduction of Transatlantic. That was great.
Thank you.
Do you do books on tape?
No, you know what? Very funny story. I know you don't have long, but I tried to read the first chapter, Let the Great World Spin, and the person who was producing it, she said, okay, come on down for an audition. I was like, this is my book. Do I have to really go for an audition? Anyway, I went for the audition, and the funny thing is that I didn't get the job.
Oh, you're kidding.
I swear to God, it's a true story.
That is, wow.
But this new novel is beautifully read by an Irish actress by the name of Geraldine Hughes.
Oh.
And I'm very happy that she's just done it. It actually just comes out this week. Well, the novel just came out 2 weeks ago, but the CD version comes out this week.
Wonderful. I love it. I love it. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you'd love to say? Did we cover it all?
I am in charge of, or the chairman of a new charity called Narrative 4, which we also launched last week. And if anybody's interested in 106 original pieces of fiction by some of the world's leading writers, they can go to narrative4.com, log on, and they will be supporting a charity called Narrative 4, which is basically an organization for young people from all around the world to come together and exchange stories.
Mm.
So, if they went on to that, that would be wonderful.
Wonderful. Colin McCann, thank you so much for coming back.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Cheers.
That was Colin McCann. The book is Transatlantic. It's published by Random House. It is out and available now. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Joan Silber will be here for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back.
Come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit us at iTunes. We are under Talk News. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. I know there's another speaker series event coming up pretty soon. Those events typically sell out quickly, particularly the summer events, so you might want to check that out. Make sure you get your seat reserved. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Joan Silber. Joan is the author of 6 previous works of fiction. Among many awards and honors, she has won a Penn Hemingway Award and has been a finalist for the National Book Award and the LA Times Fiction Prize. She teaches at Sarah Lawrence College. Fools is the book today. It's her latest collection of stories. It's published by Norton, and it's my pleasure to welcome her to the show. Joan, hi.
Hi, I'm very glad to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's no secret to our listeners that I am a huge fan of short stories, and anytime I see a collection, I immediately drag the person onto the show, so thank you.
Great.
This is a huge treat for me. So I'm going to let you talk about the collection, sort of what inspired the stories, the connective thread between them, and sort of what you were interested in and thinking about when you put the collection together.
Well, it's the third book of linked stories I've done, and I love the form. I love the way you get to stretch out and then, you know, zoom in on small parts. And this collection really started because I was thinking about anarchists in the 20s. I was thinking about Dorothy Day, who later founded the Catholic Worker and who was an anarchist before she got to be her own kind of Catholic. So as I was reading about them, I knew I didn't want to take on her as the point of view, because she wrote enough about herself. I began to do these other people she was involved with. I made up these characters. And then I moved towards other generations, the sort of sons and daughters of people who were politically active in the 20s. And the book went in all sorts of directions. But the kind of key notion for me is people who really think that life needs to be better, that you have to try harder than you're already trying. They're on all sides of that. I have one character who's an alcoholic and shifts from, you know, trying until very late in life. But I'm really interested in a kind of earnest effort, and also the way people live for ideas, how that affects, you know, their long fates.
Right, right. And tell me a little bit about why short. I mean, I know why I love short, but you've written short and you've written long, though I get the sense that shorter is where your heart sort of is. I might be wrong about that.
No, that's totally right.
Yeah,
totally
talk right. About short fiction, what it does and why you're drawn to it.
I worked very backwards from the way most writers work in that I started life as a novelist. And my first novel did fine. It won the Penn Hemingway Award. You know, I thought that was what I wanted to do. And then later in life, I think I began to see that stories could contain long amounts of time. Alice Munro was a big influence in that because she does these great leaps over time. And I just loved that because in a story you can, because of the economy of a story, if you're showing a change over a great amount of time, the change is very striking because someone's reading the story in one sitting. And I loved that. I loved the kind of moving around over a whole life within the story form.
Yeah, and the beauty of the interlinked fiction, which seems like it's become more popular, I don't know if it appeals to the reluctant readers of the short story who really kind of want a novel, but they're willing to dip their toe in when they see characters recurring or something.
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so, too. And, I think it puts the stories in this, great dialogue with each other and allows you to maybe even easier make these kind of leaps through time and eras and see how one person's decision early on impacted another person, down the generations.
Yes, yes. I loved it. There was one story where it also helps me sort of generate stories, right? I get ideas because I'm trying to pick up threads. And there's one story where there's this character, Liliane, who's a very sort of a manipulative young woman in Paris in the first story with her, and then at the very end we get to meet her again when she's in her 70s as a very kind of elegant, poised kind of woman. And I loved that. I loved that I got to sort of see her then and see her later.
Yeah, right. I love this concept of the fool, because a fool is such an interesting notion to me because, fools don't really have a lot of malice or intention. They're just bad decision makers. And so, it kind of takes some of the agency out of their equation, but it infuses it with something else. I kind of wanted you to talk about the appeal of the fool character as opposed to the appeal of just like the intentionally bad character.
That's a wonderful way to put it, that it has to do with agency. I got onto it because I was thinking about the anarchists who were clearly, even at the time, they were considered foolish and certainly have been considered, that way later on, although there's been a great revival of interest because of Occupy Wall Street, which is a whole other story. But in dealing with these, the anarchists in the 20s are after the more violent ones, so they're the last gasp of a certain strain of idealism. And it was clear they were regarded as foolish, and I didn't want to think of them that way. What I loved in them was their earnestness. So I was really playing with that notion of, what does it mean to be a fool for an idea? Isn't that better than a lot of other things you could be? And then that began to play into other things in the stories. I mean, people have plenty of things to be fools over. But it sort of means that you've let yourself image lapse for the sake of a higher idea, and I love that notion.
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Joan Silber. The book is Fools, a collection of short stories. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM. You brought up sort of economic crisis. I always think it's interesting to examine, sort of the time and place where the writer is writing stories, even if the writer isn't writing stories about, the particular time and place they're living in. And this book does seem so informed by writing it in 2008 and during the economic collapse that we were going through. And I wanted you to kind of talk about that interplay between what you were living through fictively and what you were living through in reality and how those two are kind of in dialogue with each other.
Well, the figure who comes into, in a minor way, into the story is a couple of times is Madoff, Bernie Madoff, mm-hmm. because he really duped people. I mean, he made them fools by, selling them a bill of goods. And that, often people who, you know, thought very well of themselves. So that, that the shadow of, you know, it can happen to anyone, was really important to me in the stories. And, you know, certainly all around me, you know, people were losing jobs and facing crises and, you know, under, and still are, you know, under threat. So the importance of money was hard to ignore at this time, too, and I wanted that to play into the stories in some way. I also wanted to write about people who didn't care so much about money. Because I don't think we get enough of that. I think we always assume that it's something that everybody wants and that's a primary value. And I wanted to play with that a little too.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah, I also wanted to talk about your the wonderful settings of these stories, which, you know, sort of span a lot of areas. I know you've done a lot of traveling in your own life, and sort of the setting as being kind of their own characters in these stories, and how your own travels have influenced the stories, maybe not directly, but, you know, certainly indirectly, and your relationship with travel.
Well, I love to travel, and the last book had, before this had a lot of stuff about travel in it. But I think, I mean, what travel teaches you is not to be parochial. Mm. You know, that your own way of doing it is actually not the way everybody does it. And for a fiction writer, I think that's really a gift, because you really have to sort of stand outside and look at what's going on. So in some ways, I think the experience of travel helped me deal with historical stuff, because that's another way of going outside what you know, and I was maybe more willing to do that from having traveled quite a bit. And when you travel, you are the fool, because you're the one who doesn't know how things go. You know, you're the baby. And I have learned to like that, but it took me a while to like that.
Mm. I hadn't thought of that, but that's right. That's right. You are the traveling fool who doesn't know all of the mores and the polite things to do at the dinner table, and
or how to get there. You know, you're lost down the street like an idiot. You know, I am anyway, usually.
It does. It puts you in sort of this childlike position where you're relying on, especially if you don't speak the language, you're sort of relying on cues, you know, as though you're illiterate and because you are. That's a really well-observed point. It's funny because I was talking in the first half hour to Colin McCann about fictional characters versus non-fictional characters, and how he loves to take real people from history and put them in his own settings and kind of reimagine some of their lives. And your point about, you know, taking real people from history, but then kind of taking the stuff out of them and completely reinventing them into a whole new character, and that interplay between, you know, real life people informing fictional characters, I was wondering if you could talk about.
Oh, yes. The first story does deal with the real-life Dorothy Day, who wrote a great deal about herself. I mean, she was a writer. And while I was working, just sort of digging through the Internet trying to find stuff about her, I mean, what interested me was that I had read years ago that she was pregnant as a young girl. She's kind of a, you know, village radical, and she gets pregnant once and has an abortion and much regrets it. And so when she gets pregnant again when she's 29, she really wants to keep the baby. And her much-loved boyfriend doesn't want, you know, she's getting more and more Catholic, and he doesn't want to do that. He's a radical. He's an anarchist. He can't be a hypocrite. So it's a wonderful sort of drama that I was interested in. In any case, as I'm reading about her, I discovered that Forster, the real-life guy who was her lover, it was the great uncle of someone I had known for years, that I'd known since my 20s. So I immediately called up my friend Elizabeth, this friend, and asked her everything that she remembered about him, which was quite impressionistic. And I talked to her younger sister, but that helped his character. I made him up. I mean, I really made him my character, but I feel that the sense of who he was really derived from, you know, what they remembered. But everybody else is entirely invented. And when I take the viewpoint of a person, I'm usually inventing the person, so I'm freer to do that.
Yeah. Actually, your story about that reminded me of another conversation we had in the first half hour about if there are moments when you're writing weird coincidences or things that pop up that tell you you're on the right track. You know, this is a long, hard process, but keep going, because here are signs from the, you know, I don't want to say signs from the cosmic universe, but, you know, kind of here are telltale things that will throw at you saying, you know, good job, you're doing it right. Where it sounds like this very interesting familial connection through your friend was one of those. Were there other?
Yeah,
were there other of those?
I can't, not for this book. For other books, I've had that where you just run across someone who knew someone. But for this book, I think that's the only one.
Yeah. It's not a bad one, I have to add, as they go.
She has come to two. She and her sister came to one reading, and she came to a second one. So she's a big supporter of the book.
That's fantastic. Were there characters in here who were particularly challenging to you, or particularly surprising to you, or who really has kind of been enduring character in your mind?
Well, I think the hard one probably was the second story in the collection is this guy who ends up homeless on the streets of Paris, essentially because he's an alcoholic. And that, I don't know, I don't even know why I wanted to do that, but somehow I wanted to get someone who went down in the social scale, you know, and that was the most sort of, that was the most familiar to, because I live in New York, I mean, that's what I see, right? But he was harder to do. I mean, I had to really, you know, redo a lot of stuff to get him. He's not based on anyone I specifically had in mind. And I didn't, when he stops drinking, I didn't want him to go to AA on the page. Do you know, I didn't want to have to write a recovery story because that's so familiar. Mm-hmm. So I had to figure out how to say that happened, but to say it and leap from that to his later life. So that was sort of a challenge.
Do you think that writing the other is sort of liberating that regard, or do you think it's challenging? I mean, so now you've got a male character, and you've got an alcoholic male character who's now living on the streets of Paris, who, you know, is that unfamiliarity sort of giving you more psychological license to figure out who they are, or is it so distant that it's hard to figure out?
Oh, well, I want it to be the first, obviously. I don't use my own experience directly anymore, just because, you know, I've run out of things that I would write that are my own life, and I guess I'm not comfortable doing that anymore either. So I do find it freeing, and I do find it, I mean, you're always using parts of yourself, obviously. I mean, it's like acting. You're drawing on your own emotions. But I find it very freeing to get out of my own skin and do other people. I think that's one of the great things about being a fiction writer.
Yeah, you get an escape for a little while.
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And you're titling's a tough thing for me, because especially a short story title, because it can't be obvious. It's got to be resonant. It can't be point on. And you're wonderful at it. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about finding the right. The hard part about short stories is you have to title, 10 things instead of just the book.
And certainly the title affects how people read it. Even if they forget the title, when they look again, it's in their mind. I would say, sometimes I have it right away. Sometimes I know, oh, that's great, that phrase. But sometimes it's trial and error, and I come up with some really, really terrible ones. And it takes a while to discard them. But I do try and do it obliquely. I mean, what you described is exactly how I want to do it. So you're guessing. I feel like it's a guessing game, And often when I begin a story, the provisional title that's written on the file isn't the title that I end up with, because the story ends up about being about something else.
Do you get a lot of editorial input from agents, editors on, do they give you a lot of help in this regard, or does it really have to go to them kind of fully baked?
It goes to them fully baked, okay. But I have friends that I use, and they're the people that are thanked at the beginning of the book, and I would never send anything out without it going through, maybe three friends. I don't always do what they say. Sometimes I violently disagree with them, or two of them have entirely different opinions or whatever, but at least I'm bouncing back against, readers that I trust.
Yeah, I love that. My guest this morning is Joan Silber. The book is Fools. I was reading an interview that you gave, and you said you were talking about some, favorite writers out there, and you were talking about Louisa May Alcott and Frances Hodgkins Burnett. You described them as being full of accurate passion, and that just started me thinking about the phrase accurate passion and how convenient it would be if our passions were accurate. And I sort of wanted you to talk about that, of what accurate passion means. I love the concept.
Yes, I totally forgot that I said that. Certainly, I remember reading those books as a child, and, you know, it's like you didn't know anybody else knew about that, you know, when you read them. Certainly, Louisa May Alcott has a lot of moral passion, which we don't have anymore. You know, mm-hmm. her characters are so eager to behave well and to be heroic. Mm-hmm. I think the whole goal of being a serious fiction writer is to identify accurate passion, you know, to figure out what's the pretense and what's the not sincere stuff that the character may be doing, because we all do that, and to get under, you know, what's really felt. I think fiction is really about, you know, interior and exterior going on at the same time. It, you know, when you have access to the character's consciousness, you can really get into that. I love doing that. And also because I write a lot about desire and love relationships, and there's so much inaccurate passion in that. I mean, it takes the characters a while to kind of piece it out. So, you know, it's fruitful for me that way.
That's great. I was wondering if, do you mind reading to us for just a minute? We're drawing down on our time, but I'd love to get a chance for our audience to hear your voice inside the book. Can you read to us?
Yes, I'll just read the first page and a half or so of Fools.
Perfect.
A lot of people thought anarchists were fools. I finished high school in 1924, and even during my girlhood, when the fiercest wing of anarchists still believed in propaganda by deed and threw bombs and shot at world leaders, people thought they did it out of a bloody kind of sappiness, a laughable naivete. All this laughing, I came to think, ignored the number of things a person could be a fool for in this life, a fool for love, a fool for Christ, a fool for admiration. I had friends who were all of these, as it turned out, but I took my own route. I wasn't born into anarchism. I read myself into it. Someone handed me a pamphlet in the street, and that was the beginning. And my cousin Joe was an influence. Joe was a third cousin, hardly related at all, but in our teen years, we were both enlisted in my mother's brief attempt to distribute used cook clothes to the poor in our church. Musty woolen top coats, faded school pinafores, piles and piles of men's hats. The problem was, my mother was afraid of the people who showed up for the clothes. We stood behind a table in the dank church basement while she pled for an orderly line and whispered at me not to touch the children. On the other side, Joe was muttering to me about why we had these extra goods and they didn't. I was born in India, in the city of Madras, in the state of Tamil Nadu, when my father was a missionary for the Congregationalist Church. We went home to Philadelphia when I was six, but I had memories. My father left the mission in a state of great disillusion, embittered by ecclesiastical infighting in a country so filled with suffering. In America, I was mocked for the way my speech sounded Indian, and I was hounded in school by a group of bullying girls. In my adult life, when my friends heard I came from a missionary family, they teased me about how I naturally came from a long line of zealots, didn't I? Which was how I liked to view it. Actually, the zealotry had drained by the time I was growing up. My father was just another bald, tired minister who mumbled through the services and didn't really want to look anyone in the eye. My mother was more ardent, more desperate. I hated the unbearable ladies' aid meetings in our living room and the tedious Sunday school with my poor mother teaching improbable platitudes. In high school, I was infamous for cynical jokes about the Virgin Mary. Only Joe was worse. In the school auditorium, he passed me notes parroting the psalm read in assembly. I'm going to stop right there.
That is wonderful. That was Joe Silber reading from Fools, which is the title story in the collection Fools. That was wonderful. Any last words of wisdom or advice that we could close on?
Oh, well, people always ask me what my advice is for young writers. You know, that's kind of a standard question to ask not-so-young writers. And my serious answer is cultivate equanimity, because I think it's a very up-and-down life. My own career has been very up-and-down, and being steady through it is very crucial.
I haven't heard that before. I really like that. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Joan Silber, thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you.
That was wonderful. That was Joan Silber. The book is Fools. It is out and available, published by Norton, and you can find more about her online. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great week.